TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti Commentaries. How the Free Market Killed New Orleans and Right-Wing Judicial Activism. In the fall of 2005, Michael Parenti began writing a series of commentaries addressing the urgent issues of our time. One of this country's leading progressive political thinkers, Michael Parenti brought his analytical skills to such varied topics as climate change, the media, and deficit spending. In his commentary on right-wing judicial activism that is included in this program, Parenti quotes soon-to-be Chief Justice John Roberts, who assured the Senate Judiciary Committee that when serving on the Supreme Court, he would be a neutral umpire with only the Constitution as his guide. None of the senators, says Parenti, doubled over with laughter. Parenti then goes on to prove how right-wing judicial activists, from the Civil War to now, have stretched the Constitution in matters of slavery, segregation, child labor, the First Amendment, and the awarding of the presidency to George W. Bush. But first you will hear Michael Parenti's commentary on how the free market system was instrumental in the destruction of New Orleans and the deaths of so many residents. The free market also had a role in the cutting of the budget for the Army Corps of Engineers and in the free-for-all development of the protective wetlands, and ultimately in the total mismanagement of the rescue operations. Here is Michael Parenti reading his commentary, How the Free Market Killed New Orleans.
The free market played a crucial role in the destruction of New Orleans and the death of thousands of its residents. Forewarned that a momentous Force 5 hurricane was going to hit the city and surrounding areas, what did officials do? They played the free market. They announced that everyone should evacuate. Everyone was expected to devise their own way out of the disaster area by private means, just like people do when disaster hits free market third world countries. It's a beautiful thing, this free market, in which every individual pursues his or her own personal interests and thereby affects an optimal outcome for the entire society. Thus does the invisible hand work its wonders in mysterious ways. In New Orleans, there would be none of the collectivist regimented evacuation as occurred in Cuba. When an especially powerful hurricane hit that island in 2004, the Castro government, abetted by neighborhood citizen committees and local Communist Party cadres, evacuated 1.5 million people, more than 10% of the country's population. The Cubans lost 20,000 homes to that hurricane, but not a single life was lost. A heartening feat that went largely unmentioned in the U.S. press. On day one of the disaster caused by Hurricane Katrina, it was already clear that hundreds, perhaps thousands of Americans had perished in New Orleans. Many people had refused to evacuate, media reporters explained, because they were just plain stubborn. It was not until day three that the relatively affluent telecasters began to realize that tens of thousands of people had failed to flee because they had nowhere to go and no means of getting there. With hardly any cash at hand, or no motor vehicle to call their own, they had to sit tight and hope for the best. In the end, the free market did not work so well for them. Many of these people were low-income African Americans, along with fewer numbers of poor whites. It should be remembered that most of them had jobs before Katrina's lethal visit. That's what most poor people do in this country. They work, usually quite hard, at dismally paying jobs, sometimes more than one job at a time. They're poor not because they're lazy. but because they have a hard time surviving on poverty wages while burdened by high prices, high rents, and regressive taxes. The free market played a role in other ways. Bush's agenda is to cut government services to the bone and make people rely on the private sector for the things they might need. So he sliced $71 million from the budget of the New Orleans Corps of Engineers, a 44% reduction. Plans to fortify New Orleans levees and upgrade the system of pumping out water had to be shelved. The Army Corps of Engineer personnel had started to build new levees several years ago, but many of them were taken off such projects and sent to Iraq. Much more important to be in Iraq than New Orleans. In addition, the president cut $30 million in flood control appropriations. Bush took to the airwaves. When in doubt, when confused about policy, he takes to the airwaves to let out the propaganda. On Good Morning America, he said, "I don't think anyone anticipated that breach of the levees." That's just another untruth tumbling from his lips. The catastrophic flooding of New Orleans had been foreseen by storm experts, engineers, Louisiana journalists, state officials, and even some federal agencies. And even Bush himself was apprised of that very fact. He was lying. All sorts of people have been predicting disaster for years, pointing to the danger of rising water levels and the need to strengthen the levees and pumps and fortify the entire coastland. In their campaign to starve out the public sector, the Bolsheviks, reactionaries as they are, also allowed developers to drain vast areas of wetlands. Again, that old invisible hand of the free market would take care of things. The developers, pushing their own private profit, would devise outcomes that would benefit us all. But wetlands serve as a natural absorbent and barrier between New Orleans and the storms riding in from across the sea. And for some years now, the wetlands have been disappearing at a frightening pace on the Gulf Coast. All this was of no concern to the reactionaries in the White House. As for the rescue operation, the free marketeers like to say that relief to the more unfortunate among us should be left to private charity. It was a favorite preachment of President Ronald Reagan that private charity could do the job, and for the first few days, that indeed seemed to be the policy with the disaster caused by Hurricane Katrina. The federal government was nowhere in sight, but the Red Cross went into action. Its message, don't send food or blankets, send money. The Salvation Army also began to muster up its aging troops. Meanwhile, Pat Robertson and the Christian Broadcasting Network, taking a moment off from God's work of pushing John Roberts' nomination to the Supreme Court, called for donations and announced Operation Blessing, which consisted of a highly publicized but totally inadequate shipment of canned goods and Bibles. By day three, even the myopic media began to realize the immense failure of the rescue operation. People were dying because relief had not arrived. The authorities seemed more concerned with the looting than with restricting people, more concerned with crowd control, which consisted of corralling thousands into barren open lots, devoid of decent shelter, and not allowing them to leave. Questions arose that the free market seemed incapable of answering. Who was in charge of the rescue operation? Why so few helicopters and just a scattering of Coast Guard rescuers? Why did it take helicopters 5 hours to lift six people out of one hospital? When would the rescue operation gather some steam? Where were the feds, the state troopers, the National Guard? Where were the buses and trucks, the shelters and portable toilets, the medical supplies and water? And where was Homeland Security? What has Homeland Security done with the $33.8 billion allocated to it in fiscal 2005? By day four, almost all the major media were reporting that the federal government's response was a national disgrace. Meanwhile, George Bush finally made his photo op appearances in a few well-chosen disaster areas before romping off to play golf. In a moment of delicious and perhaps mischievous irony, offers of foreign aid were tendered by France, Germany, Venezuela, and numerous other countries. Russia offered to send 2 plane loads of food and other materials for the victims. Cuba, which has a record of sending doctors to dozens of countries, including a thankful Sri Lanka during the tsunami disaster, Cuba offered 1,100 doctors. Predictably, all these proposals were sharply declined by the United States, especially the offer from Venezuela and Cuba. America the beautiful and powerful, America the supreme rescuer and world leader, America the purveyor of global prosperity, could not accept foreign aid from others. That would be a most deflating and insulting role reversal. Were the French looking for another punch in the nose? Were the Cubans up to their old subversive tricks? Besides, to have accepted foreign aid would have been to admit the truth, that the Bushite reactionaries had neither the desire nor the decency to provide for ordinary citizens, not even those in the most extreme straits. I recently heard someone complain, "Bush is trying to save the world when he can't even take care of his own people here at home." Well, that's not quite true. He certainly does take very good care of his own people. That tiny fraction of 1%, the super rich, the haves and the have-mores that he calls his base. It's just that the working people of New Orleans do not number among them. And now with global warming and with the rising sea level, we may be seeing many, many more New Orleans. But we won't be seeing much of George Bush.
That was the political analyst and award-winning author Michael Parenti reading How the Free Market Killed New Orleans. Now Parenti turns his attention to the U.S. Supreme Court. Liberal members of the court have often been accused of being judicial activists, wanting to bend the rules of law and subvert the Constitution. In this commentary, Parenti offers proof that the record shows that the opposite is true. He is now reading from his commentary, Right-Wing Judicial Activism.
Appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee as the nominee for Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts assured the senators that he would not be one of those noisome activist judges who inject their personal values into court decisions. He'd behave more like an umpire calling balls and strikes. With a completely open mind, he would judge each case solely on its own merits, with only the Constitution to guide him, he said. None of the senators doubled over with laughter. A fortnight later, while George Bush was introducing another court nominee, he prattled on about his judicial philosophy and how he wanted jurists to be strict constructionists who cleave close to the Constitution, as opposed to those loose constructionist liberals who use the court to advance their ideological agenda. Well, it's time to inject some reality into this issue. In fact, through most of its history, the Supreme Court has engaged in the wildest conservative judicial activism in defense of privileged groups. Whether it was for slavery or segregation, child labor or the 16-hour workday, state sedition laws or assaults on the First Amendment, right-wing judicial activists have shown an infernal agility in stretching and bending the Constitution to serve every inequity and iniquity of the last 200 years. Right to the eve of the Civil War, for instance, the Supreme Court asserted the primacy of property rights in slaves, rejecting all slave petitions for freedom. In the famous Dred Scott versus Sanford, 1857, the court concluded that, be they slave or free, black people were a subordinate and inferior class of beings, that's a quote, without any constitutional rights. Thus did reactionary judicial activists, some of them slaveholders, spin racist precepts out of thin air to give a constitutional gloss to their beloved slaveocracy. When the federal government wanted to establish national banks, or give away half the country to speculators, or subsidize industries, or set up commissions that fixed prices and interest rates for large manufacturers and banks, or imprison dissenters who denounced war and capitalism, or use the U.S. Army to shoot workers and break strikes, or have Marines kill people in Central America. In every one of those cases, the Supreme Court's conservative activists twisted and stretched the Constitution in every conceivable way to justify these acts. So much for strict construction. But when the federal or state governments sought to limit workday hours, set minimum wage or occupational safety standards, ensure the safety of consumer products, or guarantee the right of collective bargaining, then the court ruled that ours was a limited form of government and could not tamper with property rights and could not deprive owner and worker of freedom of contract. The 14th Amendment, adopted in 1868, ostensibly to establish full citizenship for African Americans, says that no state can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person equal protection of the laws. In another act of pure judicial invention, a conservative-dominated court decided that the word person in this 14th Amendment really meant corporation. Therefore, the 14th Amendment protected business conglomerates from regulation by the states. To this day, corporations have legal standing as persons, thanks to conservative judicial activism. By 1920, pro-business federal courts had struck down roughly 300 labor laws passed by state legislatures to ease inhumane working conditions. Between 1880 and 1931, the courts issued more than 1,800 injunctions to suppress labor strikes. No trace of conservative restraint during these many years. When Congress outlawed child labor or passed other social reforms, the conservative jurists on the courts declared such laws to be in violation of the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment says that the powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved for the states or the people. So Congress couldn't act because these were powers, this was the domain reserved for the states. But when the states passed social welfare legislation, the court's right-wing activists said that such laws violated substantive due process, a totally fabricated oxymoron. Substantive due process is a nonsensical term. Either it's the substance of the issue or the process. And this violating substantive due process under the 14th Amendment. So the states could not act because they were restricted by the 14th Amendment. So, for about 50 years, these conservative justices used the 10th Amendment to stop federal reforms initiated under the 14th Amendment, and they used the 14th Amendment to stymie state reforms initiated under the 10th Amendment. It's hard to get any more brazenly activist than that. A conservative Supreme Court produced Plessy v. Ferguson, 1896, another inventive reading of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Plessy confected the separate but equal doctrine, claiming that the forced separation of blacks from whites did not impute inferiority as long as facilities were equal, which they rarely were. For some 70 years, this judicial fabrication ruled and buttressed racial segregation. Convinced that they too were people and persons, women began to argue that the due process clauses of the 14th Amendment, which applied to state governments, and the 5th Amendment, applying to the federal government, disallowed the voting prohibitions imposed on women by state and federal authorities. But the conservative Supreme Court fashioned another devilishly contorted interpretation. True, in one decision they said, true, women were citizens, but citizenship did not necessarily confer a citizen's right to suffrage. In other words, due process and equal protection applied to such persons as business corporations, but not to women or people of African descent. At times, presidents placed themselves and their associates above accountability by claiming that the separation of powers gives them an inherent right of executive privilege. Now, this concept, executive privilege, has been used by the White House to withhold information on undeclared wars, to withhold information about illegal campaign funds, about Supreme Court nominations, about burglaries in Watergate, for instance, about insider trading by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, executive privilege, and about White House collusion with corporate lobbyists when Cheney went and consulted with those oil lobbyists and big oil guys. He claimed executive privilege. I don't have to tell you what we agreed on regarding oil policy. And you remember oil prices started moving up right after that. Well, the concept of executive privilege, which means really unaccountable executive secrecy, that's what executive privilege is. It exists nowhere in the Constitution or in any law. Yet the wild-eyed right-wing activists on the Supreme Court trumpet executive privilege, deciding out of thin air that a presumptive privilege for withholding information belongs to the president. Bush just recently talked about how important it is for us to guard executive privilege in order for there to be crisp decision-making in the White House. Crisp? How can Bush represent himself as a strict constructionist while making claim to a wholly extra-constitutional juridical fiction known as executive privilege? With staggering audacity, the court's rightist judicial activists have decided that states cannot prohibit corporations from spending unlimited amounts on public referenda or other elections because such campaign expenditures are a form of speech, and the Constitution guarantees freedom of speech to such persons as corporations. In a dissenting opinion, the liberal Justice Stevens noted, quote, "Money is property, it is not speech." But his conservative colleagues preferred the more fanciful, the more activist interpretation. They further ruled that free speech enables rich candidates to spend as much as they want on their own campaigns, and rich individuals to expend unlimited sums in any election contest. Thus, poor and rich can both freely compete, one in a whisper, the other in a roar. Right-wing judicial activism reached a frenzy point in Bush versus Gore, a Supreme Court decision done in 2000. In a 5-4 decision, the conservatives overruled the Florida Supreme Court's order for a recount in the 2000 presidential election. The justices argued with breathtaking contrivance that since Florida had different counties that might use different modes of tabulating ballots, a hand recount would violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. By preventing a recount, the Supreme Court gave the presidency to George Bush. In recent years, these same conservative justices have held that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause could not be used to stop violence against women, it could not be used to provide a more equitable mode of property taxes, or a more equitable distribution of funds between rich and poor school districts. But in Bush versus Gore, they ruled that the Equal Protection Clause could be used to stop a perfectly legal ballot recount. Then they explicitly declared that the Bush case could not be considered a precedent for other equal protection issues. In other words, the 14th Amendment applied only when the conservative judicial activists wanted it to, as when stealing an election. We hear conservatives say that judges should not try to legislate from the bench, the way the liberal jurists supposedly do. But a recent study out of Yale University reveals that conservative justices like Thomas and Scalia, have a far higher rate of invalidating or reinterpreting congressional laws than more liberal ones like Byers and Ginsburg. By this measure, too, the conservatives are the more activist and the looser constructionists. In sum, the right-wing aggrandizers in black robes are neither strict constructionists nor balanced adjudicators. They are unrestrained power hustlers masquerading as sober defenders of lawful procedure and constitutional intent. If this is democracy, who needs oligarchy?
You heard two commentaries by the nationally known political analyst and author Michael Parenti. He read Right-Wing Judicial Activism, and before that, How the Free Market Killed New Orleans. This is the first half of a one-hour program of commentaries on the urgent issues of our time. When TUC Radio returns, you will hear Michael Parenti on Government by Giveaway and Good Things Are Happening in Venezuela. With roots in a working-class Italian neighborhood in New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. He is the author of 19 books, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, The Culture Struggle, and Super Patriotism are the most recent ones. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for links with Michael Parenti's site. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this talk. This talk is also available as film on DVD. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.